Sarah Todd from the Deseret News joins me to discuss the Utah Jazz, Schrodinger's basketball team. I wonder what that means. Which NBA players would be good on Project Runway and the joy of campaign goggles. Before we get into that, though, just want to note the news that broke that Adrian Griffin had been let go as the head coach of the Milwaukee Bucks broke right after we finished recording today. Great luck. Luckily for you, though, Vinny Goodwill will be back to talk about it on the next episode of The Good Word with Goodwill tomorrow. So sit tight for that. Now enjoy our conversation about the Utah Jazz on this new episode of Divine Intervention. Oh, boredom is so terrible. It's like a dread disease. Nothing could be worse than when there's nothing on TV. I'd rather be a cowboy than to stare blank at the walls. I've been reborn so many times, I can't remember them all. Who do you want to be today? John Gennaro, count me in! Today's first words belong to Oingo Boingo from the song Who Do You Want to Be off their 1983 LP Good for Your Soul, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling today, here are three things that I am grateful for at this moment. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and to talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good gig. Number two, I was able to make a little bit of time this morning to get out for a short run. And while I was out there, a large and very kind Eastern European gentleman walking past me gave me a fist bump and said, "Stay strong," which was unexpected and greatly appreciated. But I also am wondering like what vibe I was putting out that this man felt compelled to, that he had to let me know to stay strong. Either way, much appreciated, sir. Hope you're listening. And number three, more important than all of that, I get to spend part of my morning chatting with a wonderful and illustrious guest that I am excited to get to know a little better today. My guest today is an award-winning writer and reporter whose work has appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philly Daily News, and SF Bay, among other publications. These days, she is on the Utah Jazz beat for the Deseret News, where her fantastic coverage of the local squadron earned her the crown of Utah Sports Writer of the Year. Take that, Tony Jones. From the National Sports Media Association, she also hosts Unsalvageable, a Utah Jazz podcast, which you can support on Patreon. Friends, a warm welcome for Sarah Todd. Sarah, thank you so much for making the time for us today. How are you doing?
That was incredible. I feel like there should have been an applause because it was so good. Like, but I'd be the only one clapping. So thank you.
That's all right. I'll take it because one person clapping is one more than I usually get on this show. So it's very, I'll gladly accept it.
It can only go downhill from here.
that's the divine intervention promise. Very good in the first couple minutes, all downhill after that. But I refuse to accept that that is the way it's going to go because I've asked you here today, Sarah Todd, if I'm being honest, we needed to spike the ratings on this thing and nothing gooses the numbers like a little bit of Utah Jazz talk. Am I right?
You're absolutely wrong.
Well, then I think we're going to have a hard time. But no, for real, I think that the Jazz are very interesting. I think that they're an interesting team right now because they're kind of standing at a fork in the road, like our friends from Oingo Boingo, which I only recently found out that's Danny Elfman is the lead singer in Oingo Boingo, the guy who like composed all the Nightmare Before Christmas score and whatever. Yeah, dude, it's very weird. And everybody should definitely go Google Danny Elfman just to see how my man is doing. It's a wild look. But Oingo Boingo, Danny Elfman, he wrote those lines. What do you want to be today? That question of, you know, which direction you're going to take, which path you want to go down. And I think the Jazz are kind of in that space right now. And how they answer that question, I think will maybe inform a lot of other answers to a lot of other questions in the lead up to the trade deadline. So I think they're an interesting team to talk about. Could think of nobody that I'd rather speak about them with than you. And we will get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Sarah Todd, what is something from the world of basketball that is bringing you joy this week?
Well, I'll start out with something that doesn't seem very joyous, which is what brings me joy is campaign. And campaign.
Okay.
I don't know what his like playing situation is right now. I haven't been paying the most attention to the Bucks recently. I do have a job to do that is Utah Jazz 24/7, so I'm kind of busy. But the it doesn't matter what campaign is doing. It doesn't matter if he's in the game, if he's on the bench, if he's getting a DMP, if he just hit a three over some other very prominent player in the league. It does not matter what he's doing. He has the best and most emotive facial expressions I've ever seen. And like, if you just search GIFs on Twitter or on the GIF keyboard, wherever you search for GIFs, just search campaign. And it is incredible. It's great stuff. And he had this one time where he kind of, there's going to be video of this, so I can just do the motion. He hit a three and then he turned around and looked at the Bucks bench and he like did one of these and went, bah! And I call that campaign goggles. And me and my boyfriend give campaign yes. goggles to each other whenever we roast one another. So campaign is very prominent in my home.
This is incredible for a number of reasons. One, because I think we've given our audience some homework to do. Be out there, do your Googles, check out the goggles, make sure you know what campaign's working with. But also, this is exactly the space that campaign occupies in our world, right? He came into our NBA lives basically for being a dance partner on the OKC bench, right? Yes. Like he was the guy that he would have elaborate dances with Russell Westbrook before games. And so he came in as that, like, I am a celebrator. I am somebody who's, I'm adding some spice, even whether or not I'm in the game. And then like he became a regular-ish, like, oh, I'm a backup point guard and I play big minutes on a team that's good. No. I mean, that's great, Cam. And that has made him a livelihood that I'm sure will set up his family for generations. That's a wonderful thing. But in terms of our fandom, our like watching lives, this kind of stuff is going to last way longer than whatever he did, you know, the last five games. You know, if he's able to be on the court in the third quarter of a playoff game, campaign goggles as a way that we celebrate with our loved ones. I love this.
Yeah, he's on the Kent Bazemore trajectory of being a player. Like the celebration and the spice that he adds to a bench is more important to my life than anything else he could ever do on a basketball court.
What a wonderful trajectory to be on. May we all in our own walks of life wind up on the Kent Bazemore trajectory. That sounds like yeah. a beautiful place to be. Well, Sarah, that's a wonderful addition, a wonderful source of joy. For many who follow the NBA, the game is almost secondary to the joy they get from tracking trades. This is, you know, one way to, I'm not going to sit here and adjudicate people's fandom, but that's one way to do it. And we did have a trade before we got on today. Before we turn to Utah, we'll just talk about that briefly. The Charlotte Hornets are trading guard Terry Rozier to the Miami Heat for a 2027 first round pick and Kyle Lowry. The way this was worded, frankly, I feel is a little bit disrespectful to Kyle Lowry. Let's put him first. A source tells Yahoo Sports senior NBA reporter Jake Fisher that the 2027 first round pick Miami's sending is lottery protected and then becomes unprotected in 2028, which there's a little bit of a, you know, juicy protection there. Sarah, what was your first blush reaction to hearing that the Heat went out and got Terry Rozier and that Kyle Lowry would be on his way to North Carolina?
I guess my first reaction is that Scary Terry does seem like the kind of guy that's got that hashtag Heat culture. And I guess, you know, Kyle Lowry and his dump truck are headed to another city to do probably nothing. So I don't know. It's weird because I guess you're just, you know, trading a couple guys that almost do the same stuff. I think Terry will probably help Miami a little bit, but like not enough to do what they want. I guess it seems like kind of a meh trade to me.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, how dare you suggest that it's a meh trade? Because this is the basketball internet. We're supposed to treat everything
right,
like
I
it's
know.
The most important thing that has ever happened ever and that ever will happen. I think from Miami's perspective, it's like Kyle Lowry has been really good for us, but we are a bad offense. We could use another guy who can score a bunch. Terry Rozier can do that. The fit component, like he seems like a legit kind of hard ass and Heat culture is a good fit for him. And he doesn't have to be the number one playmaker on a team that has Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo and Tyler Herro. Like I'm optimistic about the way that could all work out. I do think that's the right way to host this. Kyle Lowry's dump truck's eventual destination might be the most interesting part of this because I suspect he will not be very long for Charlotte. I don't think that the Hornets are a team that is going to be looking to have Kyle Lowry for the long term. And so he's maybe a buyout candidate. And then you wonder like where, I don't know, where it eventually parks. I don't know. I'm not sure how to land that plane, how to park that dump truck. But Kyle Lowry does feel like a guy like,
who is going to be looking at this Christmas ham?
Fair enough. All right. Very good. Oh, well, you know, listen, was it April, Easter, right? Yeah. And there's going to be an Easter ham on the table in the first round of the playoffs. And for you know, who's setting that table? Yeah. So I think that will bear some watching. And then the way with the Hornets, like, Lowry becomes the next big expiring contract they've got. Gordon Hayward's also there. There's Miles Bridges is another guy who comes up off the books after the year. Are the reporting suggests they are, this is like the start of them moving on from guys. So, you know, to be determined and, you know, where we go from there. But I think one interesting component of it. So like Terry Rozier, I think among people who do what we do, like we are familiar with Terry Rozier. He is far from a household name, even though he's, scores more than 20 points a game and 6 assists on a terrible team. But the going rate for him was big expiring contract and first round pick that eventually becomes unprotected. And so for the trade market going forward, you're like, there's a bunch of other guards out there, right? Like the reporting, I think Mark Stein had the report yesterday that it's the Hawks are asking 2 first rounders for DeJounte Murray. You know, there's Malcolm Brogdon in Portland. There's Tyus Jones in Washington. And there's a couple of guards in Utah who are they available? Are they not available? At what price point are they available? I think now having like a baseline for what this player cost could help us figure out what's moving forward. And that to me, like, I'd like to move on from there to Utah because I got you here and you know a hell of a lot more about the Jazz than I do. Here's why I find them interesting. I'll set the table for it. Second straight year, they projected preseason to finish like way below 500. Second straight year, they are hit the middle of the season like at or around 500. 22-22 going into the Tuesday game against the Pelicans. They're tied with the Lakers for 9th in the West. And they were terrible to begin the season. 7-16, bottom 5 on both sides of the ball, which I only bring up because I want to bring up what Will Hardy said after they lost by 50 points to the Mavericks. And Sarah, I'd like for you to tell the people who might not have been paying attention how Will Hardy, the head coach of the Utah Jazz, described his team's effort in that game.
That was a masterpiece of dog That's a direct quote.
It certainly
quote.
Was. And that is direct. Yeah, you could put the quotes around that. Make that a quote graphic. Put it on your social channels. That's exactly what he said. And he couldn't have said it. And the delivery, your timing was spot on. Absolutely perfect. With the way you delivered that, that's exactly how he said it. Like, he was really weighing and considering every syllable that was about to come out of his mouth. No, you know, no wasted motion, perfect efficiency. But right after that, things start to click, right? You know, they go since December 12th, so about a month and a half, 7th in offense, 13th in defense, 15-6, one of the best records in the league. So, Sarah, what changed around that time? Like, how did things start to click for the Jazz?
Well, a couple of things here. So the masterpiece of dog shit game and a loss by 50 to the Mavericks was, you know, that was the headline game. And like things started to change after that. But Will Hardy was incredibly pissed off at his team for weeks leading up to that. And there had been multiple games that he was mad afterwards. And he was saying, like, if you don't play hard and pass, then you can't play for us. Like, you don't belong in this program. And he was getting extraordinarily mad at just how selfish and stagnant the offense was. And there was a really bad loss against the Lakers. And then they went to Portland after that. And they got blown out by the Blazers early in the season, which was not a good look for any team in the league if that had happened to them. And after that game, he said, like, he was talking about how he goes home at night and he thinks about things that he could have done better as a coach. And he cares a lot about this team and he wants them to succeed. And he just wants his players to give a shit. He was like, if you don't give a shit about the Utah Jazz, you cannot wear a Utah Jazz jersey. So those are the things that were happening leading up to the 50-point loss to Dallas. And then he got so mad at one point that he was like, there was a couple of guys that were injured for whatever reason. But he was like, whatever, I'll start Omer Yurtseven, who played like 9 games over the last 2 years in the NBA. And I'll start Chris Dunn. He was in the G League last year. Like, he was just like, I'll start anyone I want if you guys aren't going to play hard for me. And I think that that kind of lit a fire a little bit. And then he really, like, he set this sort of precedent with mixing up the rotations, I think, in an angry way, where he got all of the players on this team to truly believe that he'll bench anyone. Like, if you actually don't play the right way for him, like, he does not have a, it doesn't matter what you're making, how much your contract is. Like, he doesn't have a problem with it. But he also, he got them on that side, I think, with, like, tough love in a way that they, like, respected it. I don't think a lot of the players were really mad at him, because if they were, I don't think you'd see the results coming afterwards. Like, if you really piss off a locker room, you can lose it, right? And sure, he did it in a very clever way that I'm not 100% sure how he did it. And then there's a couple of rotational things that happened there, right? Like, he stopped playing Talen Horton Tucker. The Jazz are 10-1 when he gets a DNP. So that's a thing. And Colin Sexton decided to not play like Talen Horton Tucker. And those are really important things. Jordan Clarkson,
for the purposes of clarification, for the purposes of clarification for the audience, when you say Colin Sexton decided not to play like Talen Horton Tucker, what does that entail?
Just absolutely barreling into the trees, even though you're undersized, and maybe like spinning around at the rim and putting up a shot that probably is going to like clank off the bottom of the rim rather than go anywhere near the top of it or into the basket. Leaving guys wide open on the corners, even though like you had a perfect pick and roll or pick and pop play, like not knowing where to be on defense. So just your general bad basketball decisions. Really bad shot decisions, fadeaway step back threes when you're like a 20% shooter. So, that's the kind of stuff
that'll hurt you.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that Talen has become known for, as far as I've been covering him. And Colin, it seemed like he was kind of that player, like just like a head down, barrel to the rim, don't know how to change pace, like try to score by any means possible kind of player. And now he's averaging like a ton of assists a game. He is making really great smart passes. He's changing speed in the paint multiple times, which is not a thing I'd ever seen Colin Sexton do before. And so he's complete. I mean, at the beginning of the season, I was thinking Colin Sexton is not worth his contract. And now I'm thinking, as you mentioned with the Terry Rozier deal, if he's playing like this and if this is sustainable, then he's not only worth his contract, then he might be worth more than what Charlotte got for Terry.
Yeah, it's a great point to look at it and say, well, also, just before we get further afield with it, something that I talked about with Tyler Parker on last week's show about the Thunder, like when there's guys, he was talking specifically about Coby White in Chicago, but like, we often expect these guys to kind of be fully formed products at, you know, 22, 23, whatever. Colin Sexton's 25 years old and had to like play in a lot of different contexts in Cleveland and had his career kind of, you know, there was injury and then there was Garland shows up and it's all up and down. Like maybe he just needed, maybe this is an opportunity for like a 25-year-old guy where he gets that the reps of running a team. And like, yeah, the game starts to slow down. You hear that sort of old adage all the time. And that's like, I think that's one of the more interesting things about the way this Jazz rotation has unfolded. You kind of have a lot of, I don't want to lean too hard into like misfit toys. That's not fair. But like they were at a previous stop and they were maybe expected to be like a round peg for a round hole. And they're maybe a little more square than that. Like they don't do the perfect thing, the perfect fit they were supposed to be before. And Will Hardy seems to have a real, you know, flexibility or understanding of how to make those guys fit the way or put them in the positions to succeed more comfortably. And I'm wondering if that is also a part of kind of what this has things have taken off, like John Collins playing center, which he wasn't really getting to do in Atlanta, Colin Sexton being on the ball, but also like having a little bit more of an opportunity to share playmaking responsibilities with Chris Dunn doesn't have to be a, you know, he, as you mentioned, he was in the G League. He, you know, was a lottery pick that kind of flamed out twice. And it was like, can he ever shoot well enough to justify that pick? Right. But if you have another high scoring, high efficiency guard, he can just maybe be a little bit more of a table setter and a defender, which then lightens Colin Sexton's load. Like everybody, if everybody works, you know, sort of shares the work, it's not as heavy. And that feels a little bit like what has been happening with the Jazz of late.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of your point of like Will Hardy being able to kind of get success out of guys that maybe were different in their previous stops. Something that he said to me recently was that he feels bad about buying into the narrative of about Colin Sexton. Like for whatever people believed about Colin Sexton before he got to the Jazz, like we all of us here, the coaches hear exactly what we all hear, right? Like he's a gunner. That's what he does. He scores head down. He's not like a decision-making point guard. He can't be a point guard. And Will was like, I heard that and I bought into it. And he's like, and Colin taught me a lot over the last year and a half, roughish, you know, that when I get guys on my team, that I should just maybe let them show me what they are rather than believe what they are before they get here.
Which is a really, it sounds a lot simpler than it is to not just sort of expect to go off of a player's reputation or what, you know, to try to scheme things up around what someone's perceived failings are, as opposed to kind of exploring what the possibilities are with it. And I think that, I mean, what you've seen from these last, you know, 2021 games, like, as you mentioned, Sexton has been kind of lights out as, you know, an initiator from the backcourt, just under 23 points and 5 assists, only 28 minutes a game. And he's putting up crazy production. The high efficiency shooting was always a part of his game, and it's showing up again now. 51, 42, 89 shooting splits. Chris Dunn, I mentioned him, now making just enough three-pointers to kind of keep defenses honest, which lets his defense stay on the floor. A 4-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. So he's like not making mistakes and making enough shots. So like fitting sort of snugly into a role that we didn't necessarily know he could handle. And then the offense, that was the thing, you know, you mentioned the beginning of the season, Hardy's frustration with the sort of stagnancy of the offense, which was really the like polar opposite of what things were like at the beginning of last season. The Jazz really taking other teams by surprise by how well they were playing offensively, you know, the unlocked Lauri Markkanen, and we are super going to get back to Lauri Markkanen. But you know, the all of a sudden it was like this Jazz team can score, and like, where the hell did this come from? And then the beginning of the season, really none of that. Suddenly this shift to like a more five out look, Collins and Markkanen and Simone Fontecchio and the Sexton Dunn backcourt, everybody can do a little bit of everything. They can all shoot a little bit. They can all make a play off the bounce a little bit. They can punish defenses for bad closeouts or over rotating or whatever. And that's been what has really driven this rise a lot. Like they've been so potent offensively with that lineup on the floor. I think it's around like 125 points per 100 possessions. So he has found a way to get them to an identity that seems like the way that he wants the team to play. And obviously a gigantic part of that is Lauri Markkanen, who had missed some time with a hamstring strain. He gets back and has put himself very squarely in the All-Star conversation again. I'm wondering, like, there's probably a lot of people listening to this, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on our listenership, who might not be like living and dying with every Jazz game. Yeah. So I am wondering, Sarah, like, you see him up close. How good is Lauri Markkanen right now?
Lauri Markkanen is for real. Like, I think on a daily basis, just because I am constantly thinking about what the Jazz are and what they could be in the near future or even the distant future, I find myself lately thinking, can he be a number one option? Like, because I think for the last year, I was still under the impression that he's a number one option for this team currently, but once the Jazz like get the guy that they're going for, then like maybe he'll be a number two or even a number three, depending on like how many guys the Jazz eventually go after. You know, they didn't get all of those draft picks and the Rudy and Donovan trades to sit on them and use them on a bunch of young guys. Like, that's not gonna happen. So, but like I find myself watching Lauri a lot and thinking, like, he just turned 25 or 26 to just turn 26. Why can't he be a number one guy? Like, if the Jazz aren't going to be a title contender this year, if he's just now entering his prime, what is it going to look like in a year or two when he actually figures out how to deal with defenses guarding him like he is a number one option? Like, they're being a lot more physical with him. Like, everyone's trying to deny him on everything. And so what is it actually going to look like? And he has only proven to me that he can punish defenses for overcorrecting. And so lately I've been really convincing myself that, like, he could potentially just be a number one option for a team. Like, they might be able to surround him with players rather than having to go after the big guy. And that, of course, is like a big if, and whatever happens over the next couple of years could definitely change that. But he's that good. Like, he is a legit dude.
And in a way that makes him so, you mentioned the way that the Jazz can look to build something. You can build kind of whatever you want around him, because he's good enough. I mean, he can hurt you spacing the floor. He can hurt you. He can take a mismatch into the post and bully a smaller guy. He's really good working off the ball, running off of pin down screens, you know, like, just as an active mover away from the play, drawing attention that then opens things up for his teammates on the other side. And as a defensive player, like, he kind of like started to level up into a new sort of player during that time in Cleveland, where he was like, oh, I can be a big wing and, you know, play with Jared Allen and Evan Mobley and be like a 7 foot small forward, but guard wings. And he's like a power big wing who can do some, still, you know, you can, so if you want to play him at the four with a more natural wing component, like at the shooting guard and swing spots, sure, you can do that. If you need to downsize and play him at the five for stretches, you can do that. Although I wouldn't make that a huge part of your recipe, but they don't have to. They've got Walker Kessler coming off the bench that they love and they believe in as a long-term building block. And then, you know, John Collins, that pairing has worked, although better offensively than defensively. The main knock on him right now is he doesn't set people up all that much. He's not a passer and a playmaker on a sort of plus level, but as you said, you know, Will Hardy seems like the kind of coach that's not going to put an artificial ceiling on how much a guy can improve at the areas that he's not all that good at. And then B, like, if he's already like a top 15 to 25 player in the league without that, maybe that's just friggin' fine. Like, maybe you can find other guys to pass the ball. And, you know, if he's going to, you know, finish like 52, 42, 90 shooting on super high efficiency, like, maybe that's all right. And yeah, maybe that's like, it changes the way an organization thinks about how it builds itself, because maybe you can build kind of whatever you want around that dude.
Yeah. And two things here. One, like, sure, he doesn't like set his teammates up. He's not like a playmaker or like a facilitator in the way that you would want a number one guy to be. But like, if you have three other guys at least on a nightly basis that are all averaging like over five assists, like, you kind of don't need anyone else setting the table anyways. And so that's number one. And then to your point, like, for people who might not watch them daily, talking to Rick Carlisle the other day, you know, Lauri Markkanen has been getting Dirk Nowitzki comps since he was like the leading up to the 2017 draft. Like, that's been happening for a long time, purely based on like his size and shooting ability and not really anything else, if we're being honest. But over the last couple of years, it's really started to look very Dirk-like. And Rick Carlisle straight out said the other day, he was like, he's the closest thing I've ever seen to Dirk Nowitzki.
And like, you know, you trust that guy's scout, right? You trust his evaluation. He saw an awful lot of it up close. That was the evolution in Dirk that made everything kind of unlock. Was it wasn't just he was picking and popping and spending all this time 25 feet away. It's I'm at the foul line. I'm posting up at the nail. I'm facing up and like I'm forcing switches and mismatches. And how are you going to deal with me? And for Markkanen to get there, while the context of the Jazz has sort of shifted so much around him, is, I think, a real testament to his, you know, his work that he's put in to become, to reimagine his game or to, you know, unlock other parts of it. And to, like you said, you know, Will Hardy and that staff just sort of saying, we're going to see if we can, rather than believe who people have shown in the past, like, we're going to see what they can be in here, in our system, in our framework. And for Markkanen, I mean, just the numbers are worth shouting out. The last month since he got back from that hamstring strain, just under 25 points, 9 rebounds a game, 51-41-90 shooting. The Jazz are outscoring teams by about 4 points per 100 possessions with him on the court. They get outscored by about 10 points per 100 when he's off the court. That's one of the, like, you talk about like the on-off court splits. That puts him up there alongside guys like Donovan Mitchell and Giannis. So like, impact in terms of what he's doing on the floor and how much it hurts when he's off of it. That's a really big swing. And that frames to some degree, I guess, the bigger conversation about the Jazz, because they get him back in the lineup. As you mentioned, the tactical and rotation shifts that Will Hardy put into place when they got everything together. They got the first unit going. They got the second unit figured out, like the Kelly Olynyk and Walker Kessler minutes and Jordan Clarkson with, coming off the bench. And they sort of lined everything up a little bit more neatly. And they've been two dramatically different teams. That really bad team, the masterpiece of dog team for the first 23 games. And then this other, 15-6 world beaten kind of team the last 21 games. And so super producer John Gennaro in our rundown for today called them Schrodinger's basketball team, which I really like the idea of, like, you don't necessarily know what's in the box. And then when you open the box, it's like, it could all disappear. So that's kind of the question that I want to lay out for you. This Jazz team has a ton of young pieces, guys like, as I mentioned, Kessler, Oshae Agbaji, Keyonte George, Taylor Hendricks and Bryce Sensabaugh, we haven't seen a ton from, but first round picks, they're really high on. They got a bunch of picks coming from, as you mentioned, the Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell deals, like no long-term money on the books, expiring contracts, movable deals that are, stretched beyond this year, like for Jordan Clarkson. They also have, like, depending on which projection model you look at, like a coin flip shot of just being in the playoffs, right? Like they could just make the play-in, or if they go on a run here and somebody falls off, maybe make it all the way up to six. It's maybe a long shot, but it's in the cards. It's a possibility. So who do you want to be, right? Like which door do you think they're going to be thinking about taking as they walk up to the trade deadline here in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I've talked a lot about this recently. I think it makes it a lot more difficult, but kind of like, rich man problems to have that they've been playing so well lately, because I think when they were really bad to start the season, then it was like, all right, well, okay, Colin Sexton's not a part of this. John Collins isn't playing defense. Talen Horton-Tucker is not changed. Like you could just name off which guys weren't going to be a part of this going forward, right? But now that it's started to take form a little bit, you look at Colin Sexton and you think, well, is that the future sixth man, right? Like Jordan Clarkson's not going to live forever, right? So, and as you said, he has an incredibly tradable contract.
Don't be so sure. He may well live forever.
Yeah. Believe me, if there's anything I know about Jordan, it's that he's like Big Brother on CBS, Expect the Unexpected, which shout out to Big Brother, which is one of my favorite TV shows ever. This podcast not brought to you by CBS. I don't want to make the Jazz's decisions because they're really difficult, right? Like, do we ride this out? Do we make the playoffs? I think that there are a lot of players that were really upset about not being able to really go for it last season. Lauri Markkanen has not ever made the playoffs, and he really wants to. And so I think that if you don't at least go for it and show that you're putting forth the effort for it, you really risk making someone like Lowry, who could be one of your incredibly important pieces moving forward, him losing confidence in what the team is actually doing. And so I think that no matter what they do, who they trade, what moves they make, that it has to be with the intention of getting better. I don't think that we're looking at, like a Mike Conley trade or anything that they did last year where, they were kind of putting one arm behind Will Hardy's back and saying, yeah, haha, go ahead and win games. And also, let's be super cautious with every injury anyone's ever had. Lowry will not be playing 12 of the last 13 games of the season. Like, and so I don't think that the Jazz will be doing any of that this season. And that being said, I also know that, Danny Ainge doesn't want to leave anything on the table that could be worth something, right? He's not going to let anything go for nothing. And yeah, I don't know. That probably doesn't answer the question at all.
No, but it frames the question and it sort of informs it. It's a really hard thing to figure out. Like if you want to develop players and try to figure out who's going to be part of the long-term plan, you also kind of need to see those guys under the fire, right? Like you need to see them in the heat of games that matter, as opposed to just saying like, well, we're going to remove the possibility of you competing for stuff that for a playoff spot or a play-in berth or whatever, playing in an elimination game if it comes to that, all that kind of stuff. Like, that's when you learn more about whether these guys are people you want to invest in long-term or, you know, so I think that the component of, and then also not for nothing, learning about Will Hardy too. We've just talked about a lot of really positive things about the way that he's managed his locker room, the way he's managed his rotation, the way he can kind of understand what he has and then find a way to maximize it. But also, you don't necessarily know how somebody is going to react to managing a postseason rotation or adjusting in the playoffs or whatever until you see them in that context. So there's still a lot to be learned from being in those moments that matter. And if you're a team that's got a chance to continually, you know, to put yourself in the conversation of producing them and gleaning some of that information rather than just saying, well, we'll sort of move whatever's not nailed down for some second round picks or whatever. Like, I think there's value to that. But as you say, like, if, and it was sort of going back to the beginning of our conversation, if we know that big expiring contract and, you know, protected first round pick that eventually becomes unprotected is what gets you Terry Rozier. Like, if an offer north of that comes in for Jordan Clarkson, say, you know, there's been reports about the Knicks being interested in trying to like replace the Emmanuel Quickley production off the bench that they went out the door in the OG Anunoby trade. And I'm sure they're not the only team that would be in the market for an instant offense scorer like Clarkson. Then you have to at least think about it, right?
I think you absolutely have to think about that. I think that the you know, there were kind of the, it was reported, I guess, last month that, you know, the Jazz were listening to all calls for all players, right? Like that was the report that came out. And like, I think that is, first of all, I think that's true of every team. I don't think that there's a basketball executive right. That like picks up his phone and, or anyone's phone and is like, oh, hello. Oh, no, don't say that name. And then like just hangs up really quick. Like that's not how things work. And so, and that being said, like, I think that the Jazz are really operating under the belief that they have a ton of picks. They have a ton of picks that are seemingly going to be good. And so they expect to be a part of nearly any conversation if there's anyone that's selling in the NBA. And they want to be a part of all those conversations. And that being said, like, I think they really want to be mindful of the fact that they do want to learn things from this roster. And they don't want to make a reactionary move.
With that said, do you think there's a chance that this might go the other direction and they could, you know, you mentioned Danny Ainge being mindful and opportunistic. Is there a world where they're buyers as opposed to sellers at this deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everything's on the table. Like, I think that it would take the right kind of player. But like I said, they don't have all those draft picks to sit on them forever. And I think that they see the potential that this team has. And I think that if the right offer presented itself, like, they would absolutely be willing to buy rather than sell.
Oh man. Get to the trade machine, everybody. Start figuring out who to put next to Lauri Markkanen. I'm interested in the idea of Utah acquiring as opposed to accumulating. Let's shift our focus. I love that idea.
I put together, me and a couple of the other Jazz writers stayed late after a game last week, and we all put, well, a couple of us, me and one other, just two people, decided that the Jazz were going to get both KD and Booker because the Suns were going to blow it up. That's we just independently decided that. That's not a report, but we can make the money work. We can do it.
Fantastic. Well, it's all sorted then. We know exactly how it's all going to play out. Everybody start writing your winners and losers columns now. We can put the Jazz squarely in the winner column. It's all done and dusted. That's perfect. All right. Well, Sarah, wherever we go with the Jazz, I know where we go next on this show. And we go to something that we call the closing five. Because as I'm sure you know, your certified ball knower, Sarah Todd, how you start is not nearly as important as how you finish. And we finish with five questions for our illustrious guest. Question number one. You once posited the premise that Kelly Olynyk is a tall version of Stan Podolak from the original Space Jam. He was played by the great Wayne Knight, who gave us Newman. And in honor of that, which member of the Jazz do you think would make the best character actor?
Oh, yeah. Best character actor. Probably Chris Dunn. He's like the most emotive and kind of has the most extroverted personality. So I think that if like you gave him a script, he'd be like, okay, I can do this. And I stand by Stan Podolak and Kelly Olynyk. They're not fast or good, but they're slow.
And listen, we found out like everybody is, it's all nerdy about the P3 sports science stuff. Deceleration is the new acceleration. So really like being slow is the new skill set to maximize. I think
and
that's
Kelly
what's hot in the streets for 2024.
Has that in spades.
It's got slow to burn. Question number two. Before you got to Utah, you worked in Philadelphia and the Bay Area, as I mentioned earlier. From a following the story perspective, which beat would you rather be on this season? Philly, where it's all post-Harden good vibes and Joel better than ever? Or Golden State, maybe the end of an empire? Which of those would you think you'd rather cover?
I think that I'd probably rather cover Golden State. I mean, from a following the story perspective, I mean, I've got such inside basketball brain right now because following the story, like which one's going to do better? Probably the one that has like the team that's a little bit more global. And so like I'm going to get a farther reach if I'm writing about Golden State.
Sure.
And then, but also I think that Steve Kerr is an easier person to get like a thoughtful and really meaningful quote from than Nick Nurse. And I just think that, I mean, and selfishly, it would put me in the Bay Area and put me really close to my family. So
that's all right. You're allowed to be selfish in these hypothetical questions that come up in the closing five. There are no rules governing that kind of stuff. Whatever incentives go into the structure, that's fine. Unfortunately, though, you are incorrect. The answer is watching Embiid every night. I'm so sorry. It's just it's the way it is.
I thought when
question number three,
at first, when you were asking the question, I thought you were going to ask, like, after covering them, like, which one of the storylines that you've covered would you want to go back and cover? I thought that's where we're going. And I was like, I'm sorry, I was in Philly during Bernergate and Markelle Fultz and Ben Simmons. Like, I don't want to relive that again. So, no.
I was going to say, so we can go right back to that question that you thought I was going to ask and we can answer that. But I think you just provided the answer for us there. Maybe no sane person wants to go back to Colangelo Bernergate times. That was, you know, we were all the Pepe Silvia meme in those moments. And that was a tough hang for everybody involved. Question number three. Many years from now, when you're writing an incredible memoir about your trailblazing and groundbreaking career, what will you include about the night that Jordan Clarkson got his triple-double?
I will include the fact that I called that it was going to happen when he had like four rebounds or
Whoa.
Something. I was like, Jordan Clarkson's on triple-double watch because that's a thing that we kind of joked about in Utah because it had been so long since anyone had one that it was just like anytime anyone had like some stats in three categories, we're like, oh, it could be the one, you know, like I think, you know, Hassan Whiteside had like seven blocks one time. And I was like, no, don't let this be the one that breaks it. And so like when Jordan and he's been playing so well. And so when he had like four rebounds, I was like, oh, this actually could be the one. Jordan Clarkson's on triple-double watch. And a couple of the reporters sitting next to me were like, nah. And then three rebounds later, they were like, oh my God, it might be the one. So I was the first one to call it. That's what I'll include.
I love that. What a claim to fame to be the Nostradamus of Jordan Clarkson triple-double watch. What a perfect thing to add to the business card. Question number four. You have loudly and publicly declared yourself a diehard fan of both the NBA and Project Runway. Yes. Which players not named Jimmy Butler do you wish would compete on the show for a full season?
Oh, man. Who's got sewing skills? I mean, I think that we should put Jordan Clarkson on there. Oh, man.
Add him to everything.
Yeah, add Jordan Clarkson to everything. Honestly, I don't know what the NBA is doing. Like, they just need to, like, do more with Jordan Clarkson. He's such an absolute weirdo, but also an incredible person. Like, I don't know if the video went like national, but this was two seasons ago now. There was like a man on the street interview by like a local TV reporter from Salt Lake City, and just like local news, not one of the sports reporters. And she went up to Jordan Clarkson and was like talking about like, oh, hey, like fans are welcome back in the arena now. Like, are you going to go? And he was like, yeah, I'm going to go to some Jazz games. It was Jordan Clarkson. Like, she was interviewing him, had no idea. She was like, can you spell your name? And he was like, J-O-R-D-A-N-C-A-L-R. Like, he was just spelling his name. And she was like, do you go to Jazz games? And he was like, yeah, a lot. Like, he never told her. He just went along with it. And then, like, later on in the day, she found out that she interviewed Jordan Clarkson, who plays for the Jazz. And so that person should be on TV more. I would really like, I mean, I think I just have a lot of Jazz players in my head right now, but I would really like to watch Colin Sexton compete for literally anything. He is the most intense person I have ever met in my entire life. Like, no one does anything as hard as Colin Sexton does.
So it's like a Daniel Day-Lewis kind of thing where he's just like fully embodying the role of Colin Sexton. I'm the hard charging young bull. Whatever I am doing, I am doing it 1,000%.
He, after a game recently, well, he goes and he lifts immediately after the game. And he came into the room after he was doing some push-ups, and Kelly Olynyk and him were talking. And you could tell that they were talking about doing 100 push-ups. And Colin, with just the straightest face in the world, he's like, yeah, man, counting's the hardest part. And I was like, no, Colin, no. The 100 push-ups are the hardest part. And he's like, no, I got to 82 and I lost count. And I'm like, oh my God. So
I would like to see that guy on television. I don't know about this. I mean, the sewing, as you said, is always the differentiator on competition shows like that. But
I don't know. Anya won season. She won season 9 or 10 and she couldn't sew worth. And that was an absolute travesty, tragedy. That's an injustice I'll never forget. So maybe Colin Sexton could win Project Runway.
Listen, I believe in you, Colin Sexton. If you're, and I'm sure you're listening, so thank you for your patronage. And yes, I support your candidacy for the next season of Project Runway. Question number 5. This is an important one. That's why we saved it for last. Before he worked here, Jake Fisher had a podcast called Please Don't Aggregate This, on which you appeared as a guest. Just between you and me, which one of us is better at this?
Just between you and me?
Yeah, he's not.
Then you're better.
No. He's not on this one.
Oh my God. I take it back. I love you, Jake. That's so difficult. You guys, I love the both of you.
Can't do it. Answer correct. 5 for 5. Perfect score on the closing 5, Sarah Todd. So the thing about this show, though, is that the closing 5 is a little bit of a misnomer, because we do another thing after closing 5, and it's a weekly recommendation. This is yes, we're all very mature here on Divine Intervention, and we say doo-doo. The weekly recommendation does not have to be about anything about basketball. It can be about whatever. Previous selections include going to the library, cooking for somebody to show them that you care about them, a book about facial recognition technology, songs by different bands, etc. So it can be anything you want, just something that you think is cool and good that you would like to share with the people. So, Sarah Todd, do you have a weekly recommendation?
Sure. I was going to recommend a book, but I'm actually in the middle of it, and so I don't want to say that it's good if I don't know the end of it is going to be good, although it's a nonfiction, okay. So the end is already out there, I guess, but okay, I'll do this. I'll give a book recommendation and then also a music recommendation. So my book recommendation, which I cannot vouch for the end, is The Wager by... author unknown, because I'm not going to look at my iPad and figure it out right now. But it's about a shipwreck back in the, I think, the 1700s. Ugh, all right. I'm not obviously not paying enough attention to this book as I'm reading it. It's really crazy, though. I don't know if any of you guys have heard Scurvy.
It's by David Grann. David Grann of yes. The New Yorker.
If you've ever heard scurvy described, it's insane. It is unbelievable that anyone ever survived a boat ride ever. Like, it's just the most insane thing. The description of scurvy is lodged in my brain forever. I used to live in Norway, and there is this Norwegian musical artist whose name is Filter with a P-H, P-H-I-L-T-E-R. And you'll recognize it if you look it up on Apple or Spotify. Okay. He's always in like a pink bunny costume, which sounds insane, I know. But it is some pretty chill, cool stuff. And I like listening to it when I'm writing.
I love that. We love chill, cool vibes that we listen to while we write. Fantastic work. And also, don't ever downgrade yourself for not knowing the name of something with the book. You're reading a book. You're doing a reading thing, and you're doing something that's outside the context of just basketball work. You're expanding your brain. This is good.
Last year, I read 31 books, and it made me really, really proud of myself. And so I'm aiming for 38 this year.
Incredible. That's so good. I see. Now I have like parent brain, where there's no real reading. I've done very little real reading in the last, I don't know, like 9 years, an embarrassingly small number. I bet it would not total what you read last year in the last 9 years. So I'm working my way back bit by bit. And my recommendation for this week is, it's a comic book. And so I'm going to engage a late pass here because it started running in 2012. So I'm years and years behind, but it's called Saga. It's by a writer named Brian K. Vaughan, who is the guy who wrote Why the Last Man, and he wrote on TV's Lost. Illustrations by Fiona Staples. It's beautiful, beautiful art. And the comic book series, the like sort of elevator pitch for it, is it's kind of like Star Wars meets Romeo and Juliet meets Game of Thrones. Galaxies spanning conflict between two warring worlds, been going on for generations. A soldier from the one side that has wings meets a soldier from the other side that has horns. They fall in love. They betray their home worlds. They have a kid, and they've got to keep the kids safe. And it is a very, very, it's beautiful. The beautiful art in the book. I'm only a couple of volumes of the graphic novels into it, but I like could not put it down. Went out to the library and put the next three or four on reserve. Going to be ripping through that. So if you like comic books, if you like sort of fantasy, epic, science fiction-y kind of things, it's also for mature readers. So it literally begins with childbirth, and there's a lot of wild ass stuff in there. There's people with robot heads. There's a lot of stuff going on in the story, but it is wildly enjoyable. And I think gets at a lot of the general sort of feeling of what do we owe to people who are different than us, even if they seem like they are our enemies or on the opposite sides of us, what can we give to one another, and what do we owe to people who are different than us? And I think that's kind of a cool thing to think about, even if it's in the context of, you know, robots and horns and wings and stuff. So that is my recommendation for this week. I also cannot recommend heartily enough that every single one of you go and check out Unsalvageable, a Utah Jazz podcast. Sarah Todd, where can people find Unsalvageable, a Utah Jazz podcast?
You can find us anywhere you get podcasts. Just search for Unsalvageable. And we also have a Patreon. You can search us Unsalvageable there. We've got player interviews that are coming on the Patreon, interviews with special guests. We're doing call-in shows. So you can, hear your own voice on the show if you want to. And me and my co-host Greg Foster, we don't always just stick to the Utah Jazz. We talk about league news every time that it comes up. Anything that's going on around the league, we talk about it. And we talk about stuff that's not even NBA related, because I'm an insane person and there's no way to keep me on track. You can tell just by listening to me on this episode. So, we cover everything.
And you do it. What I love is in the most recent episode, right off the top, you and Greg Foster are very proud of yourself that you wrote down an outline. And I'm like, that's how you know that we're getting professional on this broadcast. That's how we know we're moving in the right direction. It's listen, I have to do it for this show. You guys are doing it for that show. And then you're the rocket ride to stardom starts here.
The problem
Joey is... Joey Devine behind the glass. Always good to have a Devine on board. You know, listen, the rocket ride to superstardom starts here.
Yeah, the problem is that we were doing outlines for like a year and we just stopped doing them. And so we've really got off the rails.
Well, if you are looking for a basketball podcast that also sometimes is not a basketball podcast, that often goes off the rails, Unsalvageable, a Utah Jazz podcast, wherever you find fine audio products. Sarah, is there anything else that you would like to point people toward on your way out the door, where people can find your work, etc.?
Yeah, you guys can find me on all the socials. I'm at NBA Sarah everywhere. And if you want to read any of my work, it's at Deseret.com, Deseret.com.
That's going to do it for this episode of Devine Intervention. Thank you so much to Sarah Todd for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with herself. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you've enjoyed what you just listened to or watched, do us a favor. Give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Wherever you're listening to us, subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend, tell an enemy. It's what helps with growing the show and discoverability. And that's going to do it. Thank you for listening. We will see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.